was white, in his 50s, and poorly. He smiled broadly and nodded compulsively as others spoke, whether he agreed with them or not. "I'm a tax collector," said number three. The responder was black, of the same age, but heavier in build. He sat with his arms resting on the rolls of fat collecting at his stomach. He wore tiny glasses that all but disappeared on the enormity of his round face.
"Wow," said number one with a chortle. "You're hated as much as defense attorneys."
Number three raised his eyebrows.
"Or, depending on your politics, as much as prosecutors."
Number one cut his laughter short. Discomfort flashed noticeably in his eyes, but he smiled through it and bobbed his head in polite agreement. The strangers eventually ran out of meaningless things to say. The sound of the long hand on the outdated clock on the wall rifled through the air, a click every minute. The seconds between, at first a breezy 60, grew longer as time and patience wore thin.
"We all know he's guilty."
The declaration came from juror number six, loud enough to carry to all of the room's occupants. A significant number of them shuffled uneasily in their seats. "The judge instructed us not to talk about the case yet," number three shot back. Defensively, number six looked down at her rose-painted fingernails.
"I'm just trying to save us time. Get us home at a reasonable hour. If we can get a feel for where we're at now, we can shorten our deliberation."
Juror number eight extended her right hand to number six, shoulders now sagging, chest deflated, and laid it over her forearm. The fingers were chilled, but the gesture was warm. Number eight had a daughter of similar age.
"She was just trying to help,"
number eight said, tight-lipped, her eyes locked with the girl's.
"It wouldn't hurt to get an early count."
Juror number 17 cleared his throat. He was a lawyer, a fact he had mentioned several times. His conspicuous cough redirected their attention. He answered with self-effacing diligence.
"Before we begin deliberations in earnest, the judge will ask us to elect a foreperson. We can just do that now and save time that way."
No one dared make eye contact with him again, lest he take it as an indication that he ought to nominate himself. Instead, most eyes moved to number one, the oldest, a man, and a white old man at that. Even the progressives in the room tapped into muscle memory, turning instinctively for leadership to the one who most looked the part. Number one smiled, acknowledging the vote of confidence. But his grin soon faded as anxiety took root.
"I don't know," he stammered.
He looked to the side.
"How about my friend over here?"
he said, placing a plump hand on the shoulder of number three.
"He's awfully professional."
Number three's eyes softened behind their spectacles. The compliment was both surprising and flattering.
"And I think it would look better."
The sharp but fleeting pain of a microaggression sliced through the black man like lightning. His heart rate accelerated. His breathing came short and staccato, and the hairs on his arms stood at attention. But seconds later, his vitals returned to stasis. He said nothing. It was forgotten. A wave of nods surged down the table. By murmured assent, number three became the black face of the jury. Earl Thomas bought his first car at age 28. It was foreign. Its black steel gleamed in the South Florida sun. That was by design. Earl washed it just about every day. He had kept his focus trained in high school, his nose buried in boring books filled with technobabble in college, and his head down thereafter as he inconspicuously ascended the ladder at his nondescript job working for nondescript bosses. All for that car. He loved that car. It was his status symbol. 10,000 miles later, he kept it pristine. It looked just like new. Officer Lance Hollister noticed. He flipped on the blues and reds, triggering their accompanying wail. Unsurprising.